Good afternoon and welcome to Middle East in Focus. I'm Esti Chandler. On the eve of the inauguration of the Trump 2.0 administration, Curry Peterson Smith examined at Truthout ways the incoming Trump administration is preparing to carry out another major chapter of state violence in the U.S. He wrote, quote, "The mass deportations that Donald Trump is planning aim to be in the same league as the internment of Japanese and Japanese Americans in World War II. Attacks on progressive nonprofit organizations, particularly those involved in the movement to stop the genocide of Palestinians, as well as plans for sweeping criminalization of protest, call to mind the McCarthy era of the 1950s and the counterintelligence program QuantelPro of the 1960s and 70s, end quote. Civil rights advocates wasted no time ringing alarm bells and taking action in response to a directive signed by President Donald Trump, which many see as going beyond laying the groundwork for another travel ban targeting Muslim-majority countries, as one executive order issued can also be used to target foreign nationals who are already in the United States legally, as well as target international students advocating for Palestinian rights. And as the Friends Committee on National Legislation reported in their weekly update, although a temporary quote-unquote ceasefire is in place in Gaza, violence in the West Bank is steeply escalating, with a new Israeli military operation underway there at the same time as Jewish settler attacks on Palestinian villages in the West Bank are on the steep rise. The new U.S. administration is already showing that, like the Biden administration, they are ignoring Israeli violations of the fragile ceasefire agreements recently signed with Hamas and Hezbollah, and are thus far not seeking to quell Israeli military aspirations to expand campaigns of violence elsewhere in the region. I am very happy to be joined today by Odelia Mader, of the aforementioned Friends Committee on National Legislation, or FCNL's, Program Associate for Middle East Policy. Odelia Mader is the Program Associate for Middle East Policy at FCNL, where she lobbies for nonviolent and long-sighted U.S. engagement in the region. In 2022, Odelia co-founded Negev Media, an organization promoting representational and solution-based media regarding the Arab Bedouin in Israel and the world. Having grown up in Jerusalem, Odelia's perspective is built upon professional and personal experience, and her work remains focused on promoting human rights, peace, prosperity, reducing violence, and resolving long-lasting conflicts in the region. It is my pleasure to welcome Odelia Mader to Middle East in Focus.
Thank you so much for having me. I really appreciate it.
And we really appreciate you being here to help educate us. Odelia, last spring you wrote about the Houthis' response to the genocide in Gaza and how it garnered them a new level of support from Yemenis, including many who didn't support them before the assault on Gaza began. You wrote, quote, "When it comes to Palestine, it's a very clear-cut situation for Yemenis to understand," end quote. I wonder if you can elaborate on that and talk about one horrific tactic that both populations have been subjected to, which is famine. Both populations are facing starvation by their oppressors. So can you talk about whether the emergency efforts to get food to those being starved, especially in the north, are succeeding?
Yes. Thank you, Esti. This is a really good question. And thank you again for having me on this show. A couple of things on the aid situation in northern Gaza is that we have seen an influx of aid trucks entering Gaza. So somewhere between 600 and 900 a day, according to reports. wherein for several months, aid trucks were entering in the low tens and 20s into Gaza. So on one hand, more aid in is extremely urgent and a welcome change, but I would consider two huge things. One is before the war began, 500 trucks of aid were entering Gaza daily. So 600 to 900 a day now, when over 1.8 million people are internally displaced, likely even more. We are in peak winter conditions in Gaza, and people's need for aid is even more immense after 15 months of war. That 600 to 900 number of trucks in a day is meager. Another huge problem is that the ceasefire is only temporary right now, and it needs to be permanent in order to ensure that the influx is consistent and actually meets the needs of these millions of people. Additionally, there have been reports that Israeli forces are preventing people from returning to northern Gaza, even though that was part of the ceasefire agreement. Because Israel is saying it would not retreat from the, very fortified area called the Netzarim Corridor, which divides Gaza into two and allow residents to cross back home until another female hostage was released from captivity. So this massive collective punishment. And then just today, Israeli forces shot and killed a Palestinian and injured 18 others who were gathered at a checkpoint near the Netzarim Corridor. So that's kind of the situation that I am hearing about northern Gaza, but a really big part of the issue right now is that journalists, international journalists, are not allowed in to document this critical point in time, the humanitarian catastrophe that's unfolded over the last 15 months. And so our information is not complete. And we need this information for US lawmakers, for international entities, and for NGOs like ours to get our network into action. And so while mainstream media, I'm sorry to say, is kind of terrible in actually depicting what the situation is, Israeli officials and Israeli authorities are not letting journalists in to depict the situation. And the depth and anguish of the developments in Gaza are not really being seen. And that's one reason I just wanted to share real quick an appreciation for KPFK and Middle East in Focus for giving advocates like myself and others a stage to share the really harsh reality we are exposed to from folks on the ground that are so deeply affected by US policy.
Thank you. And I think you put your finger exactly on why they are blocking outside media from coming in, because they know that the stories that get reported are going to be horrifying.
Absolutely.
Israel also passed a law banning UNRWA, the United Nations Relief and Works Agency for Palestinian refugees in the Near East, from operating in Israeli. They passed the law, the Israeli parliament passed the law in October, but it went into effect this week, and it would block them from operating in Israel or territories that they occupy. And as noted by Amnesty International, quote, the law amounts to criminalization of humanitarian aid, end quote, because UNRWA is actually the structure, the skeleton that all agencies rely on to deliver aid to Palestinians. The law also flies in the face of the International Criminal Court of Justice, or sorry, the International Court of Justice order for Israel to ensure sufficient humanitarian assistance and facilitate basic services. So I wonder if you can talk about Israel's new law banning UNRWA and if there's evidence that that law has affected aid from flowing into Gaza during, as you say, this temporary ceasefire. And, if FCNL or other allies are planning to work on Congress together to try to get Congress to do something about the situation.
Yeah, absolutely. All really good questions. And, these laws, the Israeli laws banning communications between Israeli officials and UNRWA, will go into effect on the 28th of January. So that's in 2 days.
Okay.
And I want to frame this a bit so folks listening have a better understanding of just how deeply Humanitarian aid is being politicized while millions of people are in dire need of aid right now. So, like you mentioned, UNRWA is the skeleton, the backbone of humanitarian operations in Gaza. They've been running and have built substantial infrastructure with and in collaboration with local communities in Gaza, the West Bank, East Jerusalem, and also in not Israeli controlled areas. So in Lebanon, Syria, and Jordan. And they're providing aid, medical care, education, and more to millions of Palestinians throughout the region. So, like you'd mentioned, in January of last year, the Biden administration and Congress decided to cut off US funding to UNRWA as a gut response to allegations made by Israel against 12 of 30,000 of their employees for partaking in the October 7th Hamas attacks. The funding that the US has halted to UNRWA is $300 million a year, just about, give or take. The US is the main funder for UNRWA. And I just want to point out the comparison between that contribution to humanitarian aid, imagine $300 million, in juxtaposition with over $20 billion worth of weapons sold or sent to Israel. I wanted to note about the Israeli allegations on UNRWA employees that to this day, Israel has not provided substantial evidence to back their claims. But nonetheless, UNRWA immediately terminated the contracts of their employees who were accused. The UN launched an internal investigation. This was an inspector general investigation, an outside review of UNRWA's mechanisms and procedures. And UNRWA has taken concrete steps to implement all of the recommendations made in this investigation. Since that investigation, all other donor countries to UNRWA, 15 other donor countries, have restored their funding to the agency because they saw how prompt UNRWA's actions were and how committed they are to neutrality. So this was a disastrous move on behalf of the US government, prompted by the Israeli government's long-lasted effort to annihilate this humanitarian agency and politicize aid to Palestinians. So now, like you'd mentioned, we're facing this law that passed the Israeli Knesset, which ultimately considers UNRWA, this humanitarian agency, a terrorist entity, and is prohibiting Israeli official interaction with UNRWA as an agency. It's still unclear to us at this point and people at UNRWA how this law will play out. There are a few different speculations that we're hearing from Israeli officials and from humanitarian operators. One is that there could still be UNRWA facilities in Gaza, the West Bank, and East Jerusalem, just not in interaction or collaboration with Israeli officials. And this is particularly dangerous as UNRWA is now deemed, as I said earlier, a terrorist entity and can therefore be targeted directly by Israeli forces. Another speculation that has come from some Israeli official sources would basically be that UNRWA's activities would move under another UN agency, the UNDC or United Nations Development Corporation. So basically, they'd move all UNRWA employees to another body to do the same thing and change the name. We do know that UNRWA operations will continue in other countries where their work is extremely critical as well. So in Lebanon, where hundreds of thousands of people are displaced, and Jordan, and Syria as well. What we at SCNL are focused on right now in regards to UNRWA are bills to restore that US funding to UNRWA in both the House and in the Senate. So we have two bills calling to restore UNRWA funding, one Senate bill recently introduced by Senator Welch and five others. No California senators are on there yet. I'm putting a little asterisk there. And a bill in the House with 72 co-sponsors. It will be reintroduced soon in this new Congress, as bills have to. So we're hoping to get from 72 co-sponsors on that UNRWA Restoration Act to at least 100 members on that bill with the help of constituents like those listening right now. And if you want to help us out, you can check out fcnl.org/UNRWA. That's UNRWA. fcnl.org/UNRWA. To put in an ask for your member of Congress to support the bill. So, real quick on these bills, it's important to note that we are under no illusion that it will be easy Or even possible that the Trump administration will restore its funding to UNRWA immediately. But this is a decades-old institution that is not going anywhere, and it will continue running. It's been at least a decades-long effort by the Israeli government, by anti-Palestinian organizations to completely annihilate UNRWA. So we have our work cut out for us, but we already have built a strong foundation of members supporting the crucial work of this agency. It's also important to really build that bloc in Congress, who will put more pressure on the Trump administration and send a signal to other countries that they should continue funding UNRWA. And finally, the Israeli Knesset law, it's extremely detrimental to UNRWA's work, but it's not a done deal. And how the Israeli law will be implemented is uncertain at the moment. So our work is really serving both a short-term purpose of pushing for humanitarian aid to enter now and a long-term goal of restoring U.S. support for the most substantial humanitarian aid efforts in the region.
Right. That is all very informative, and we want you to keep in touch with us about when those two bills get renumbered and reintroduced. Important to note that one of the reasons Israel has wanted to get rid of UNRWA is because they serve a refugee population, and Israel wants the world to believe that there's no such thing as a Palestinian refugee. You're listening to Middle East in Focus on listener-supported KPFK. I'm Esti Chandler, very happy to be joined today by Odilia Matter, Friends Committee on National Legislation's Program Associate for Middle East Policy, discussing challenges since the temporary ceasefire agreement has taken effect. And evidence showing the Israelis to be breaking the agreement via restricting entry of medical professionals from Gaza to shooting Palestinians trying to make it back to their own towns and villages. Odilia, the extreme right-wing turns of the U.S. administration follows the longtime turn of Israeli administrations, if it can be said, equally as far right. I wonder if you can talk a bit about the Israeli far right and their strong desire for this ceasefire agreement not to proceed, and for the genocide to continue.
Yeah, absolutely. The political counts in Israel vary, but it's been extremely disheartening for me as an Israeli American to see just how much power the farthest right parties in the Israeli government have. So these are namely Ben-Gvir's Jewish Power Party and Smotrich's religious Zionism parties. They have and continue to escalate an already extremely racist and violent Israeli government. It's not like without them, this government would not be horrific to Palestinians, but they have catapulted us into this genocidal dystopia. They have so much power over Netanyahu, and in that sense, they had so much power over Biden, which was really, really, really disheartening to see. So Netanyahu, I feel like this might be a consensus among a lot of Americans that I talk to, and even members of Congress across the political spectrum. Netanyahu is really concerned about one thing, which is remaining in power and not paying for the consequences of his corrupt actions in the past. He has moved and swayed for the aforementioned Israeli officials, Ben-Gvir and Smotrich, who have threatened to leave the government this past year, if any concessions are made for Palestinians. They've cited that any prisoner release amounts to the release of terrorists, which is factually untrue, and that the quote-unquote job needs to be done in Gaza, which other than, genocide or mass killing of everyone there doesn't seem to be any other vision behind that. So when the ceasefire deal was announced January 15th, Ben-Gvir and his party resigned from the coalition in opposition to the deal, citing that the imminent threat of Hamas terrorists exists as long as we're not fighting them to the very end. Again, the end is not clear. He vowed, though, to return to the coalition and thus strengthen Netanyahu even more if the fighting in Gaza continues. And that has been promised by Netanyahu. Netanyahu has ensured to the Israeli public on the Israeli media that Israel will continue its operations in Gaza. And meanwhile, the far right in Israel is also endorsing what you'd mentioned earlier, which is this exponential rise in settler violence in the West Bank. And we've seen this escalate since the ceasefire deal was made. There have been pogroms, murders of Palestinians, burning Palestinian homes, cars, land, and displacement of Palestinians in the West Bank, which is largely ignored at best by the Israeli government, and it's largely ignored by the US right now, support to Israel. And Netanyahu also announced an operation in the West Bank in Jenin, where Palestinians are being killed, displaced, and mass arrests have occurred. So this also has not been questioned by the current administration. I want to note that, among the Israeli public, polls are showing the majority of Israelis support a ceasefire and hostage deal. They're tired of war, and most of them do not adhere by any means to the ideology behind these far-right parties in Israel, this greater Israel ideology that calls to conquer lands in the region. So right now they have their eyes on southern Lebanon, the West Bank, and even Jordan for this messianic purpose. I hope it goes without saying, these people absolutely do not represent Judaism. They do not represent Jewish people like myself, who think that the only way for us to comply with our faith is to always prioritize human life. So the amount of power that these specific people have in the Israeli government is so dangerous and appalling.
I join you there as a fellow Jewish American. Yesterday, it was reported by Zatayo that the Israeli government continues blocking American medical workers from the humanitarian organization RAMA from leaving Gaza and returning to the United States. 11 doctors and nurses who entered Gaza on January 9th with authorization and clearance from the Israeli government and were set to leave on Wednesday were denied exit by Israeli officials who told the group that they couldn't leave due to an unspecified incident at a security checkpoint. It is unclear what incident they were referring to. COGAT, the Israeli agency that coordinates humanitarian aid entering Gaza, didn't answer specific questions about the group. And one of the doctors in the group said that the only major incident the group was aware of involved Israeli forces firing on Palestinians returning to their homes in Rafah. I wonder if you have any additional information about this incident or if you can speak to this pattern of Israeli officials preventing American medical workers from leaving Gaza and returning to the United States.
Yeah, of course. And first, I think it's really important to note Zitteo, the media platforms I've seen report on this and talk about this very evident targeting of any medical aid, including, staff and medical supplies by the Israeli government. It is well documented, and we've heard and read in our work at FCNL endless testimonies about this. And I think the world kind of became more aware of instances like this in the very high-profile case of Dr. Abu Safiyeh, who was the head of the Adwan Kamal Hospital and detained late December by Israeli forces, and maybe even tortured in the notorious Israeli Sde Teman detention camp. So we've heard from humanitarian operators on the ground, as well as international organizations who send doctors to conflict zones, that these are the hardest and most challenging conditions they faced, and that obstacles are constantly being placed before these doctors are allowed to enter and do their incredible work. One obstacle, for example, that I heard a few months ago was a change that was made by COGAT That would basically only allow each doctor two pieces of luggage into Gaza, and that needed to include all of the food that they would eat over their 2 weeks there and no medical supplies. This is already them going into a hospital with a dire lack of any medical supplies. So doctors return from missions and tell us that they had no materials to carry out life-saving operations because of this lack of supplies. And there's so many more examples like this. At FCNL, we've worked with incredible, incredible organizations like Rebuilding Alliance, like Doctors Against Genocide, who have brought the same American doctors who served in Gaza to Capitol Hill to give testimonies before members of Congress and their staff. And as I noted earlier, international press is not allowed in Gaza. So some of the only Americans who can actually witness and testify on what they've seen there are doctors. And I can tell you now, their testimonies are heartbreaking. They have risked so much to bring them to where it matters most. And so, together with these doctors, we've asked Congress members and now Secretary of State Marco Rubio to push for further humanitarian access, doctors and medical supplies to get into Gaza, and provide for more medical evacuation of tens of thousands of cases of those needing life-saving treatment outside of Gaza.
Well, Odelia, we can't thank you enough for your very informative reporting and the incredible work of FCNL. We look forward to having you back on the show to discuss the Israeli street and so we can better understand the ethos going on there. As the Zateo reported this week, at the same time, Israeli soldiers are blocking American medical workers from leaving Gaza. The doctors on the Rama team also report that they are preventing another team of doctors who are part of a larger convoy of health care workers from entering Gaza. The team of 50 were forced to leave Israel and return to Jordan, and it remains unclear if and when they may be allowed to enter. Dr. Adam Hamawi, a U.S. Army combat surgeon veteran, whom Senator Tammy Duckworth credits with saving her life after she was wounded 2 decades ago during the Iraq War, is among the convoy of medical professionals trying to enter Gaza. Hamawi, who was also among a team of doctors temporarily barred from leaving Gaza in May, told Zateo that Israel has, quote, continued to hinder entry and exit of medical and humanitarian workers since the beginning of this genocide, end quote. The blocked convoy led by the UN and Rama includes at least 14 Americans. Israel's decision to block the groups underscores the freedom they are given to break the ceasefire agreement without U.S. government scrutiny. For the first test, and this is the first test for the new Trump administration in the region, Israel's actions also renew public concerns about the U.S. government's commitment to ensuring the Israeli government protects Americans in both Gaza and the West Bank. The senators representing states where the doctors trapped in Gaza hail from include California's Alex Padilla and Adam Schiff. Is that their phones that I hear ringing? I sure hope so. Once again, I want to thank our guest, Odelia Madder, Friends Committee on National Legislation's Program Associate for Middle East Policy. I also want to thank Ozzy Flamenco for his production support today. Our theme song is The Overture from Summer Night's Dream by Marcel Halife. For KPFK Los Angeles, I'm Esti Chandler, wishing everyone in the Southland safety from the LA fires. Thank you, Kay, and of course, for taking this time to put the Middle East in focus.
Please help keep independent journalism alive and KPFK radio strong. Sustain a Circle member of KPFK by pledging at any level. $10, $20, $100 per month, whatever suits you.